Everyone, welcome to our podcast on decolonizing economics as an outcome of our summer academy course. We will try to present some of the materials that we had studied over the week and what personal impressions we have of decolonizing and of decolonizing economics specifically. We will begin by introducing ourselves. I am Suhasini. I'm from India.
Hi, my name is Mariam and I'm from Egypt.
Hi, I'm Jamie and I'm from the UK.
Hi, this is Amul and I'm from India.
So you can see that we are from varying countries, and that brings a lot of different backgrounds together. And it's interesting that we all have a common interest in decolonizing economics in specific. So we will start by asking what it means to decolonize and what it means to decolonize economics specifically.
I think we can start by thinking of decolonization as discipline of social sciences, or even a sub-discipline of others, like post-colonialism or anti-colonialism. And there's an umbrella that we can talk about. That's the domination of Western epistemologies in the interpretation of social and economic changes in what we can call the East, which is versus the West, or the South versus the North. And I think in that sense, this domination has not only been irrelevant and misleading in its understanding of the post-colonial realities of these societies, but it has also resulted in a continuous weakening of the ability of these societies to pursue a self-determined path of development. For example, postcolonialism was founded as a distinct discipline of studies after the publishing of some seminal works, including that of Edward Said on Orientalism in the 70s. And Said was a Palestinian American scholar whose contributions notably marked the beginning of many postcolonial studies. He came from a Middle Eastern origin, and his critique to the Western studies of the East was mainly pressing on the cultural presumptions imposed by the Western scholars, and also the romanticization of the East. On the other hand, decolonization was more concerned with the process of delinking the political, social, and economic evolutions of societies that were previously colonized by international powers from those of their ex-colonizers. Samir Amin is an example. He's also a Middle Eastern scholar, but he had a deeper infield activity in Africa, and he coined the term Eurocentrism to try to reflect the great structuralist inequality based on the unequal material exchange between the core and the periphery.
So we would also like to highlight the rise of neo-colonialism in the form of global financial institutions like IMF and World Bank. So after the end of World War II, the Western Allied forces, they came together to decide the fate of global economic order. So this is not something different, or what Samir Amin says, this is Eurocentrism, in which like, we have the right to decide for all of the humanity, for all the countries. IMF has this blanket assumption that global financial market is flawed, especially in poorer countries. So the conditional financing to the poorer countries under the name of structural adjustment program is nothing but a neo-colonial way of dictating terms to global south. Poor countries who are like already fighting with various problems like poverty, hunger, inflation, they are burdened with high and high amounts of debt. So this is a quote where I read from an article. I'll link it in the description. It says, quote, "While traditional colonial practices involved the subjugation of countries through military and political dominance, neo-colonialist states leverage the pools of conditional loans, cultural hegemony, and economic superiority to sway another country's economic policy, generally under the pretense of economic assistance," unquote. already there is a power imbalance in developed and underdeveloped or poorer countries, and due to the colonial past and the neo-colonial policies which IMF and World Bank are trying to impose, it results into more and more inequalities in terms of trade and exploitation through unequal exchange. Talking about debt, so one of the most important African leaders in 20th century, Thomas Sankara, he made a brilliant speech on debts owed to Western countries by African countries at the summit of Organization of American Unity somewhere in July 1987. In his revolutionary speech, the Burkina Faso leader, he argues that these debts are nothing but neocolonialism. Sankara goes on to say that colonizers, the past colonizers, ruled over us, managed our economies, plundered our resources, and left us with these gigantic amounts of debts. We have no connection with these debts, and we should not pay these debts. So unfortunately, like after just 3 months when he made his speech, Sankara was overthrown and he was assassinated brutally in a coup led by his friend, comrade, Blaise Compaoré. And allegedly, he was supported by Western powers. So this is one very dark side of neo-colonialism.
So decolonization is a very broad process that has a lot of different component parts within it. Some examples of steps towards decolonizing our education could be diversifying knowledges and sources of knowledges, decentering the production of knowledge, deconstructing colonial and neo-colonial ideas, dismantling colonial and neo-colonial structures and institutions, devaluing hierarchies, and you could add a lot more to that list as well. But many decolonial scholars would argue that it's important to recognize when the entire decolonizing project is being pursued and when only some of the component parts are. So for example, if you're just diversifying and deconstructing, then you should acknowledge that that's what you're doing rather than claiming that you are decolonizing, as that's seen by many scholars to be separate.
Yeah, I think we should also maybe remind ourselves that decolonization is an act, and it's a revolutionary act, and that it should not be reduced to one form of policy or another. It should not also be confused with other projects like social justice or human rights. And in its very core, it's an act that may have very unfavorable consequences for the once colonial powers, which might be irreconcilable with the pre-colonial status of the colonized. It means a lot of loss, material losses for the North.
Now that we have seen and understood what is the difference between diversification and decolonization, and how diversification is just a part of decolonization, we can go on and say, and I would like to ask, why do you think we need to reflect on decolonization, especially in economics?
I think we can, we should try to acknowledge that economics as a discipline, and especially in its mainstream approaches, it has been very disengaged from discourses on colonialism, racism, and imperialism when trying to tackle issues related to growth and inequality. And in this case, we find history is totally muted and perhaps only seen through the lens of institutionalism, like models of growth considered to be successful by the global North were attributed to having better institutions like democracy, good governance, and so on. However, the history of exploitation, whether in the form of human exploitation or land, it's only thought of as a matter of past, and hence decolonization is totally out of scope from the current mainstream approaches in economics.
So I would like to raise an example. The theory of development of capitalism, the global capitalism, is like it completely ignores the role of resources, land, the labor. So the The Industrial Revolution was founded on the firm grounds of deindustrialization of colonies. Take, for example, India's textile industry. It's a remarkable example. Western countries sold these products to global South at the point of gun and making colonies the captive markets for their products. And the now so-called main economic, mainstream economic theories is preaching the world about laissez-faire and comparative advantage, which is totally bizarre.
Another example I think I'd like to add here is the railway system in India. The British who are our colonizers are often praised for establishing the intricate railway system that we see in our country, but it is ignored or it just goes unnoticed that they did it for their own gain. They wanted goods and services to reach as far into the country as possible. So the main motive there was not out of goodwill, but simply because they needed to gain something. And the environment also saw a lot of destruction when creating these rail lines. And there was a loss of forest cover and, you know, hills were destroyed and so on and so forth. So to this date, what they see as assistance in creating a better system is nothing but exploitation of resources.
Economic theory also ignores cultures and philosophy. For example, the concept of Ubuntu in African culture and philosophy. The Ubuntu means I am because we are, the humanitarian worldview towards social and economic relations, recognition of others' contribution in my life or our lives, and giving back to the society. So these values are ingrained in some cultures, in African cultures, in many tribal cultures across the world. However, the economic theory that we have been taught only taught us human subjects as utility maximizing agents. And it completely concealed the aspects of human nature as social animals who are maximizing or trying to maximize welfare of the community and practicing altruism. That part was completely put under the carpet. So this poses a question whether universally accepted Homo economicus has any natural or scientific grounding, or is it just an imposed idea by the global north?
Yeah, thanks, Suvashini and Amo, for the examples. I think they better contextualize what we are talking about. They better demonstrate the extent to which the modern economic theory is ignoring such history and trying to reduce the way to ending poverty and the way to growth in the form of only in institutions or growth models that were designed and pursued by the North, but exploitation is there, then that's very ignored. I think maybe even at the more extreme, the pursuit of like mathematically modeled behavior, which Amol was also talking about, it's a global project and it's certainly not based on any social or political context.
Yeah, exactly. When the social aspect is ignored, there's a lot of factors that goes unconsidered. And the final theory is built upon so many assumptions that is not grounded in reality. So the theory just becomes unusable in everyday life. It's not applicable for everyone. It is so often forgotten that economics is at its core a humanitarian and a social subject.
I think also the need to bring the decolonization discourses to the field of economics is at this moment is more imminent because, I mean, than any other time. We can see that the current global economic system is surviving on the persistence and often deepening of inequalities worldwide. It has shown its ugly side very recently, specifically in the global north. If we go back to 2008, And even now, and the frequency by which the North has been witnessing these crises recently, whether financial or whether for financial or real causes, these frequencies, it has stirred a lot of criticism in the academic spheres, even as to whether this system is sustainable or not. I think it's definitely a moment of time in history where the system's weakness should be seized in order to bring to the table the indispensable need for breaking free of the one-size-fits-all economics education.
Yeah, absolutely. We also can't understand our economies and societies in the global north without acknowledging and understanding our colonial past and our neocolonial present. It's not just in the global south where we need to decolonize societies and economics and education. We need to do it in the global north as well.
Yeah, I would add that it's also a perfect moment to show the world that different approaches, these have always existed in the literature, many of which originate from this global south, and contributions from elsewhere in the world, be it Latin America, Asia, or Africa, these are valuable and they offer alternative understandings of the whole world. And these have been always subdued and much ignored, as we already mentioned.
Yeah, there's an argument that can be made that differentiation could lead to more rigid classifications and assumptions, and people take in the banner of we are all human, we are all living in this world. But I think those differences are important because it helps us understand the situations and the backgrounds and the environments that people come from. We are all in extremely different situations and we might not all have the same need. And it's so important to acknowledge that once we take the view of binaries as something that will help us understand and be more inclusive of different backgrounds, then economics as a subject will be able to move forward in a much faster pace than it is now.
Yeah, so this seems like a good time to raise the concepts of positionality and situatedness. So these ideas tell us that differences in social positioning and power shape our identities, who we are, and our social access. And then those things in turn affect our opinions and our knowledges and how we see things. So as an example, I had a privileged upbringing in the UK, which meant that although I could see some of the problems with the economic ideas that I was taught, they didn't really clash much with my own lived experiences. So that meant it took much longer for me to see the issues of what I was taught and to see the need to decolonize economics, because it wasn't obvious to me how Eurocentric my education was. It just seemed very normal. And that's because of my positionality and my situatedness.
Yeah, I had economics both in school and now I'm pursuing a degree in that. And I was not taught much from scholars who weren't white men. So in school, I used to just brush it off because, you know, you're just taught the most basic things. So maybe if I go pursue a degree in that, there'll be a lot more diversity. But it wasn't there. And it irks me a little to see that. Maybe it's because of ignorance or racism, but sometimes people just don't see it as a point. They're like, there's a thought that, oh, everyone has the same lived experiences, but that is not it. And we should acknowledge that.
Yeah, I agree with Suvashini, and I think that the importance of trying to reflect on our, I mean, each one on his own positionality or her own positionality is that we will finally come to realize how diverse our backgrounds are and our identities. And we can also figure out that our economic behavior is not really reflected by the mainstream economic theories. I actually did not encounter the discourse on decolonization until very recently, although that I received my bachelor in economics about 12 years ago in Cairo University. And while I was studying macro and microeconomic courses, I was always thinking to myself, so this is how the economy works, or this is how I should behave as a consumer. So I have to say that later on, I realized that thinking about all these optimization processes all the time, it has caused me a lot of anxiety when I was trying to make choices to buy something, for example, something that's very, I mean, it's a very simple decision that a person can take, but due to education, it has made the process much more complicated. And because I always wanted to optimize my choices, spend less and get more. And it has definitely been hard to try to pursue this all the time, especially having thousands of options now. And when I learned, I came to learn about new approaches to economics when I started my master's in France and South Africa, I was very happy and relieved. And it suddenly made sense why it didn't make sense before, because there's more to economics. There is pluralism that is needed. There are other approaches, other perspectives that are there, maybe less popular, but they are there.
Honestly speaking, I absolutely had no background in economics until I decided to pursue my master's degree in economics. But I did have my world view, how I look at society and how society works. When I started reading economics, which was part of my syllabus, it literally did not make any sense to me. I could not believe the ability of economists to model anything and everything under the sun with oversimplified assumption and intense mathematization. I believe that economics has a power to change millions of lives in either of direction, good or bad. And it's depressing to learn that economics does not account for value judgments and maintains a neutral position. But I found these theories like they are far from reality. This is how world works. The complexity of human nature, social relations, the environment, seems to be missing in those theories and in those models. And there I started searching for other economic theories, more diverse worldviews. And I firmly believe that the selfish acts of butcher, brewer, and baker do not encompass the totality of their drivers for economic transition. There is more to that. A woman or a mother staying home and taking care of the whole family is not rationally maximizing her utility, but she's obliged by certain social power relations. I found this new economic lens and understanding of the world more satisfying and exciting because I could now make sense of the world.
Yeah, it. I think from what all of us have spoken, it's so clear to understand why we need to decolonize and accommodate the differences and the diversity we bring with ourselves. But how do you think we can decolonize economics education?
So as we've already heard, there are loads of different ways to think about decolonizing, how to decolonize our societies. And that means, of course, that there are therefore also lots of different ways that those ideas can be applied to decolonizing economics education. So the first point I'd like to start with is that we would need to abandon the idea that economics is an objective universal science, or that it should be striving to achieve that status. Ideas do not become the mainstream of any science, particularly any social science, just by explaining the world in the most effective way. That's the kind of pure view of philosophy of science. But in reality, that's disrupted by differences in power, differences in access, and differences in funding for different viewpoints and different groups of people. and historic power imbalances and the repressions of peoples and ways of thinking are far more responsible for Eurocentric economics being our current mainstream economics than any kind of Darwinian competition between ideas, with the strongest making out on top. And then on top of that, it also can't be, so that's why it can be objective, but it also can't be universal. No theory or worldview is going to explain the entire diversity of human experiences and economies all around the world. We need a range of ideas. Our ideas are always shaped by our experiences, our situatedness. It's far more honest to acknowledge those influences and our own subjectivity than to attempt or pretend to be neutral and unbiased, because that's an attempt that's always doomed to fail, as we've talked about with situatedness and positionality before. We can get much closer to what you might call objectivity, or a universal, broader, at least, view of the world, by sharing our own individual subjective views with others, and then thinking about and discussing the overlaps, the similarities, the differences to reach a common understanding. If instead economics continues to attempt to be neutral, to have a single universal understanding, that will inevitably be in line with the dominant power structures and norms. It won't be neutral. It will only seem neutral to those that are benefiting from those power structures and therefore don't see the clash with their own lives and their own lived experiences.
I agree with Jamie, and I think on a personal level, maybe we need to unlearn what we already learned in order to be able to relearn what we don't know. And I think it's in general it's a positive attitude towards most things in our life. We all grow up in relatively small spaces, and we tend to think that the whole world works in exactly the same way that we experience. And then little by little, we start to see how the world is big and full of different people. So different cultures, nestes, and so on. And in many cases, this represents a departure point of conflicts for like people who think there is a sense of threat to their identities. But it's definitely an opportunity for enriching our human experience. I think the same applies to the way we should think about learning new approaches to the study of our economies and let go of the clinging monotonic things that we learned at school or at university.
Yeah, I agree with what Miriam said. Our economic studies right now is trying very hard to be neutral and not take sides. But when trying to be neutral, a very specific demographic is considered. It's usually Western centric. So when that happens, we can't encompass all the differences that we come with, obviously. So the scholars from Global North tend to reject the ideas that the scholars from Global South bring in because they think, because obviously whatever works for the Global South is not going to work for the Global North. But at the same time, they sort of forget that what applies in the Global North doesn't apply to the South either. They see it as a one-way street, and the very thought of that has to change.
Absolutely. The first step towards decolonizing economics education has to be dropping this idea that economics can be the same everywhere. And perhaps a second step towards decolonizing economics would be to teach about the role of empire and colonialism as central to the development of the global north, as well as teaching students about the negative consequences of empire and colonization for the global south. This would also include the ongoing neocolonialism of the global south by large corporations from the global north, and the impacts of this, both in terms of the ongoing benefits for citizens of the global north, as well as the ongoing harms to the global south. It would also mean acknowledging the embeddedness of the economy in social power relations more widely, including structural discrimination. And then the next, perhaps the most obvious to those that are least familiar with decolonization, would be to diversify the teaching materials to draw economic ideas from authors with different backgrounds.
Yeah, teaching a wide range of economic theories originating from thinkers of various race and gender and demographic location is so important for us to understand the obvious things where we have talked about before, like the backgrounds and the situations of people. This diversification also helps us unlock the ideas that philosophers had talked about before and give us an historical context that might help us better understand the present situation. What prompted the philosophers to come up with that idea, given their historical situation, could also be applicable to this date. And this influx of new ideas can stimulate more discussion and thoughts about areas that have now slipped mainstream focus.
Absolutely. Creating a more diverse economics doesn't just make it closer towards being decolonized. It does also make it better for all of the reasons that you've just talked about. If we have people with a broader range of backgrounds, that's also going to mean more cognitive diversity. And then because different approaches to the economy are going to take different assumptions, different methods as their starting points, they're going to provide overlapping and complementary knowledges about our economy, strengthening economics. And then our final proposal towards decolonizing economics education is to take a relational approach to teaching, meaning that the educator would acknowledge that they don't have a monopoly on knowledge, that academia and formalized research and journal articles are not the only valid source of knowing about the economy, and that actually students, particularly in a diverse classroom, are going to have a wealth of knowledge about their own economies, and allowing these knowledges to be shared rather than just having the lecturer speaking at the front will provide a much richer education and give students the opportunity to practice their communication skills as well as breaking down existing hierarchies.
I would finally add maybe to the way of teaching economics that it's not enough to try to incorporate critical thinking to the teaching of economics in order to decolonize it. So Takan Yang, in a seminal work called "Decolonization is Not a Metaphor," they argue that decolonization should not be reduced to a type of consciousness, a clear one that is only achieved by learning how to think critically and hence criticize a settler's perspective. I think it's important that, as they argue that the restoration of land and material to the original origins, I think it's similarly important to bring to the center the contributions of the Southern scholars to economic theory.
In the end, it's hard for us to give references or citations in the podcast itself, but not all the ideas that we have proposed in the podcast is our own. There's a lot we have taken from decolonial thinkers and activists and resources. It is important that what we have talked about right now is a personal proposal, and there's a lot of valid different ideas that you might also be coming with. So this is why it's important to decolonize economic education. Thank you everyone for listening to the podcast, and we leave you here.